news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe, taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all, it is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be your host, and of course, leading you followers of the unexplained in pursuit of the mysteries of our existence as we do every week in homes around the world, every pocket virtually. That's right, listen on demand via podcasting apps everywhere. So, hope you guys had a great Halloween weekend. Lots of news to cover, including why a record number of Americans, according to one recent poll, have said that they are relocating. The reason might surprise you. This and also ancient discoveries that are rewriting history. And on a peculiar note, why the White House says it is delaying the release of a batch of files that it says is going to protect against identifiable harm. Yeah. I don't think I'm the only one who's concerned about their reasons for withholding this information. That, an Aussie UFO update, and much more. But then later in the program, we're going to travel back in time and look at truly what is one of the strangest stories that I think I have ever come across. And that's saying a lot, considering how long I have been providing news, updates, storytelling, analysis, investigation about the unusual on programs like this. Yeah, this is definitely one for the books. It involves a UFO sighting, a mysterious illness, and then the disappearance of a man in 1959. This is the story of a man named Jerry Irwin, about whom a book was written by a gentleman by the name of David Boor a few years ago. I first learned about this case, like many others did, from a book by Jacques Vallée, written many decades ago. But we're going to take a deep dive into this story and look at what it might actually point to. There's a weird overlap here. I'll just go ahead and tell you. Somewhere between UFOs and MKUltra, that's where this story seems to land. So, all that and much more awaits. Of course, first and foremost, I hope you guys are all doing great out there. Had a wonderful Halloween weekend, wherever you are, however you celebrated. For the most part, on my end of things, I celebrated by playing catch-up because, you know, one of my computers went down last week. But we are back online. Everything has been backed up. All the previous backups have been loaded onto the new machine. And when this kind of thing happens, usually that causes me to go through my entire system and fine-tune things. So, you know, I have to do a few audio mods, install new cameras, you know, recalibrate some of the equipment. So hopefully everything sounds really good this week after all of the house cleaning that has ensued in recent days. It's kind of like getting a new haircut. I'm sure some of you out there know what I mean. You get the ears lowered and all of a sudden you have a new lease on life, or at least you feel like it, right? So, despite all of the hard work, despite the expenses, you know, nothing's cheap these days, but indeed everything is operating like a well-oiled machine here in the bunker, and that's how I spent my Halloween weekend. Well, actually, I did escape long enough to join my Sasquatch Tracks co-hosts and cohorts, Jeffrey and Smokey, and their families, and we went and saw Dune on Saturday. And yes, you heard right, we actually went to a theater to do this. Ladies and gents, I have not been in a movie theater since before the pandemic, and of course, in this era of concern that is the COVID-19 pandemic, I of course had some reservations. But the theater that we went to, apparently during the shutdown, underwent some modifications, and so I was pleasantly surprised that upon arrival with so few people there, with the redesign of the theater and everybody able to spread out, I mean, the nearest person sitting closest to me was maybe 5 feet away. Yeah, it was actually a much more comfortable experience than I had anticipated. But I've got to tell you, I think I was a bit taken off guard by how good Dune actually was. Some of you guys may remember the old version of the film, right? David Lynch's rendition on this, starring Kyle MacLachlan. And this latest update, this latest attempt to make this film, and this has really been a long-standing sticking point among sci-fi fans of Frank Herbert's novel series. They say that there really has never been a film rendition that does the novels justice, and that's really what the reviews that I was reading had to say about this one. They said, you know, again, it's a great film, but it still falls short. So maybe it's the measured expectations I always have when I go into a circumstance like this, but I go in there and I'm thinking, how long is this movie? How long am I going to have to sit here and watch this? And Jeff, of course, graciously had bought the tickets for everybody as a sort of Halloween gift, so I was just kind of along for the ride on this one. But I sit down, I'm watching the film, and shades of 2001 A Space Odyssey, which again, depending on what kind of a moviegoer you are, that is either the most boring film that's ever been made, or it is just absolute eye candy as far as cinema experiences go, and I'm in that latter camp. Back when I was in college and I actually was taking courses on film, cinematography, and analysis of cinema, this was one of the films that you're made to watch, right? 2001 A Space Odyssey is arguably one of the best films ever made. And your film teachers, when you go to school and you study this stuff, that's what they will tell you. And that's what my teacher, Lee Holcomb, told me. And even though I fell asleep the first time I tried to watch it, I didn't give up, like a lot of people do, and just conclude that it was incredibly boring. No, I actually rented the film, and I watched it again, and then I watched it again. Over the years, I've watched it several times, and I maintain it is incredible because of what it really did for the standard that it set for sci-fi cinema. And that's part of the reason why I remain fascinated by the story and the film to this day. Even the art for this podcast, the main podcast artwork, is inspired somewhat by that alignment of the moon, the sun, and the planet Earth as depicted in that film. But I'm watching Dune on Saturday, and I'm seeing shades of that, you know, with the looming spacecraft, some of the long shots, the very, what you might call, sterile environment of the desert landscape. And again, this film really captures both, I think, the awe-inspiring aspects of sci-fi, especially when it involves space, but it also really captures something else, too. There were a lot of eerie elements to it, but I've got to say, I think part of what really made it great seeing Dune in theaters was the surround sound. Because, like so many of you out there, I haven't experienced that since before the pandemic. And it was really a treat not only to be able to watch a film, but also to hear that film in such a immersive way. So, I came away from watching Dune with a slightly different perspective than I guess a lot of people, who, understandably, are still watching most of their films at home. And even if they're watching it on a fairly large screen, they're sort of accustomed to that kind of experience. Maybe my takeaway was this amplified version of what many see that film as having been on account of how I was able to see it. And again, that's really, I think, the whole reason people like going to the theaters. This is really why. Since there have been movie theaters, people have loved watching films in that setting. Dare I say, it was almost like seeing a film for the first time all over again. So, the film comes highly recommended. Go watch Dune, everybody. If you like sci-fi, you may enjoy that film like I did. Do so safely. If you don't live in a community where you feel like you can safely watch this in a theater, given the COVID-19 concerns, watch it at home. But I definitely thought it was a good film. But now, getting over into some news, of course, with Halloween still on many people's minds right now, I'm sure a lot of you guys out there were probably visiting corn mazes, haunted houses, and doing other kinds of spooky activities along those lines. But according to study finds, in a recent Halloween-themed article that they featured, one recent poll indicates that 83% of respondents claimed to have witnessed paranormal activity inside their own homes. They don't have to go to a haunted house on Halloween. They say that they've experienced inexplicable activity in their own homes. As they report, the survey of 1,000 people across the country conducted by Cinch Home Services also found that 3/4 of the individuals who were polled are still living in the purportedly haunted houses, although they say nearly 2/3 say that they believed in ghosts before they had their own experiences. 30% said that their experiences actually pushed them toward believing. Now, what, you may be asking yourself, do people actually claim that they have experienced? It seems that some people say that they have heard strange sounds. That's about 46%. A slightly smaller percentage, 42%, said that they have seen lights turning off and on by themselves. 1 in 3 participants said that they have even heard voices in their homes. While most Americans, they say, are sticking it out with their supernatural neighbors, this poll also finds, however, that 1 in 10 respondents say that they were so concerned by the experiences they were having in their homes that they actually moved. That's right, 1 in 10 respondents say they actually sold their house because of weird things that they were experiencing. Now, maybe I'm the outlier here. I don't live in a haunted house, although admittedly the bat cave-like atmosphere here in the bunker does certainly, on certain days of the week, certain times of the day, maybe corresponding to certain levels of gloominess outside, especially this time of the year, yeah, it certainly has a bit of that kind of haunted house vibe, and I like it. But then again, I'm that kind of guy who gets invited to visit real haunted houses and stay the night there, and I do that. Now, could I tell you that the house is indeed haunted, like many people claim? I don't know. Really, it depends on what a haunting is. Now, a physicist, of course, would tell you, well, there's nothing to that. We know that things like ghosts couldn't possibly exist because this is directly in conflict with the known laws of thermodynamics. In other words, the idea that some aspect of a person could exist apart from their physical body and endure after death makes absolutely no sense in terms of physics. And therefore, based on that logic, physicists discount the possibility of the existence of ghosts. Now, for my own part, I don't really have a dog in this fight. I'm not terribly concerned about whether ghosts exist or not. But one thing that certainly remains is that people throughout time have claimed to have seen ghosts. People have claimed to have had experiences with things that they couldn't explain. And one thing that this has caused me to do is to consider whether the idea of a ghost is really what we often assume that they are. Since a ghost often takes the form of a human being from a past era, we assume, well, then that must be a dead person, right? Many people claim that they have had contact with deceased loved ones, or even may have seen an apparition of a deceased loved one shortly after they passed away. It would be pretty hard not to conclude, therefore, that this is some aspect of that individual that persists even after bodily death, right? But then there's the other interpretations of what ghosts and ghostly phenomena might represent. What about time slips, right? What if ghosts, rather than being the spirit or soul of an individual, which of course requires believing that things like spirits and souls exist, and again, maybe they do, the thing is, we don't understand really exactly what that is, and whether the idea of a soul is a concept, much like the idea of a ghost may also be a concept. Again, if we're to approach this scientifically, and this isn't challenging anybody's beliefs, you know, their religion or anything like that. No, I'm merely saying that if we are to take a scientific approach toward this problem, the first question I have is not one of, well, does the idea of a ghost, as we understand what a ghost is, conflict with the laws of thermodynamics, and therefore can we conclude that ghosts don't exist? No, my approach instead is if people claim that they have had this experience throughout time, people in ancient times say that this has occurred, people in modern times still say that they have these experiences, then what might the underlying phenomena actually be? And is our dismissal of this phenomenon based on our conclusions about what we think it is and how that relates to physics, you know, are those approaches actually flawed? In other words, might there be a whole different phenomenon behind what we call ghosts, but we presume that these are spirits of the dead, or what have you? You know, these are the kinds of questions that go through my mind. So maybe we shouldn't rule out the experiences that people have, but maybe there is a different underlying phenomena than what we have long presumed ghosts to be. And of course, the psychologist or the psychiatrist might have a whole different interpretation. They might say, again, yes, there is probably a phenomena, but that stems from within the mind, not from within the environment. However, at the end of the day, much like I would look at the UFO phenomenon and say that there are probably a whole different range of things that people have experienced throughout time that might fall under the umbrella of the UFO experience, I think it's very similar with ghosts. A lot of people just have very active imaginations. At least some people may also be experiencers of mental issues from which their perceived experiences with ghosts may arise. But then there are those people who don't seem to fall into those categories and who seem to have nonetheless experienced something very real that they can't explain. And unfortunately, over the years, it seems that there is, despite there being a lot of research into paranormal phenomena, very little seems to have been done that takes this sort of holistic approach and tries to understand the varieties of things that people experience that might contribute to our broader belief in ghosts and the supernatural. But one thing sure seems to be evident. A lot of people believe they've had experiences that troubled them enough that they've actually sold their houses and relocated because of that. You know, it must have almost been a ghostly experience for some archaeologists in recent days who unearthed a series of Roman sculptures. This kind of thing must literally feel like traveling back in time. I know when I've visited museums in places like Portugal and seen some of the Roman-era sculptures there, it certainly felt like that for me. But Yahoo News UK reports that archaeologists digging on the route of the HS2 high-speed railway have uncovered an astounding set of Roman sculptures. These were recovered from an abandoned medieval church in Stoke Mandeville, Buckinghamshire. Two complete busts of what appear to be a man and a woman were found, plus the head of a child. They report that other artifacts, including a hexagonal glass Roman jug, was also uncovered, with large pieces still intact, despite being in the ground for what is thought to be more than 1,000 years. Dr. Rachel Wood, the lead archaeologist for the HS2 contractor Fusion JV, said in a press statement that the discoveries were hugely significant because they're really rare finds in the UK. She said to find one stone head or one set of shoulders would be really astonishing. Naturally, I guess the next question would be who the models might have been. Who posed for these statues, right? Obviously, they appear to depict a family. Anybody's guess who they might be? Maybe archaeologists with a little more historical sleuthing will be able to determine that. As far as historical sleuthing goes, you know, one of the most frustrating things that can happen to a historian is hitting a wall. In other words, reaching a dead end where your sources run dry. You're on the way to solving a mystery, maybe not unlike the one we'll be focusing on, involving the strange UFO sighting and subsequent disappearance of Jerry Irwin a bit later. But the case I am talking about at the current time involves one of the greatest American tragedies and longest-standing historical mysteries of modern times, and that, of course, is the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Well, hold on, you might be thinking. We know who killed JFK. It was certainly a tragedy, but there's no mystery there. Well, I would beg to differ. And I don't think we necessarily have to go down the conspiracy rabbit hole to recognize that there are lingering questions about what happened on that dreaded day in Dallas. And the sad thing is, we're never really probably going to know. We'll never get the full story. Lee Harvey Oswald, the guy who was presumed to have killed Kennedy, was killed himself by Jack Ruby within hours of the assassination. Ruby, of course, famously said he did it because he had in his mind this troubling image of Jackie Kennedy having to sit there in a courtroom and the killer of her husband being brought out. And Ruby said he wanted to spare Mrs. Kennedy the torment of having to sit there and see the trial of her husband's killer. He just thought it would be better to go down there to the courthouse with a gun and take matters into his own hands. Great idea, Jack Ruby. Wonderful. You really solved the problem for everybody, didn't you? And of course, what we are left with is more questions than answers. But then again, there are, of course, all the government files about the Kennedy assassination, many of which remained locked up for decades. And in fact, until just a few years ago, they were supposed to remain locked up. A few of them, however, have now seen the light of day. If you guys recall, just a few years back, a trove of documents were eventually released. And indeed, there are some very odd things in those files. Like, for instance, a strange phone call made prior to the assassination to the embassy in London saying that there was going to be something happening. Watch for big news in the United States. That's not a conspiracy theory. That is actually in government files that were released about the Kennedy assassination. So it seems pretty evident that something was going on, right? Somebody must have had foreknowledge of what Lee Harvey Oswald intended to do. Now, I've been down there to the motorcade. I have gone into the old book repository building. It's now a museum. I've gone up there and stood within feet of where Lee Harvey Oswald is presumed to have taken the shot from. They've got it encased in glass. You can't actually get over there into the area where Oswald stood. But from the very near proximity that I've been and looking down onto the Dallas motorcade, I do believe a man probably could have made that shot, almost certainly could have, unlike a lot of conspiracy documentaries over the years have claimed. But a few years ago, when the files that the intel agencies had on the Kennedy assassination were due for review and then release, the intelligence agencies said to then-President Donald Trump, look, you know, we need some time to review some more of these documents. Some of these really should not be completely released to the public yet. Give us some more time. And that's exactly what the last administration did. Well, last week, it was announced that within the new administration, the White House has said that it will now further delay the release of these long-classified documents. President Joe Biden wrote in a statement that the remaining files, quote, shall be withheld from full public disclosure until December 15th of next year. That'll place it nearly 60 years after Kennedy's assassination in 1963. The White House said that the National Archivist has yet again said that they need more time for a review into that redaction, which was slowed by the pandemic. President Biden also said that the delay was, quote, necessary to protect against identifiable harm to the military defense, intelligence operations, law enforcement, or the conduct of foreign relations, and that this, quote, outweighs the public interest in immediate disclosure, unquote. Now, one might assume that there are mundane reasons for this further withholding, at least until next December, of these Kennedy documents. One might presume that the information contained therein is fairly mundane, but of course, we're protecting various U.S. assets, methods of collecting information, things like this. All the same reasons, essentially, that all the UFO information is withheld, right? We don't care about the UFOs. We just don't want you to know how we gather the information we have about them. That actually could harm national security, or so they say. But based on what little we saw in the last release of the Kennedy files after all these decades, there certainly seem to be some rather interesting insinuations, a few bombshells, I would argue. And if that was the stuff that they deemed releasable to the public, one has to wonder what might be in the current batch of documents undergoing review and redaction by the archivists there in Washington. You know, if the last batch was any indication, I bet there are still a few loose ends to be tied up in this historical mystery. And yes, I maintain it's a mystery still. All right, more in a moment when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Are you somebody who, like me, keeps up with all the latest news about UFOs? Well, obviously, if you listen to this program, it seems like you do. But if you're really like me, you probably also keep up with everything. I mean, science, technology, historical mysteries, all the things that are fascinating about our world and the existence that we share. And if you're like me and you do share a passion for knowledge about everything happening in our world, I want to remind you to head over to MicahHanks.com, because even beyond the mysteries that we discover together here on the Micah Hanks program, over at my website you'll find out about all the podcasts that I produce, which include Sasquatch Tracks, my archaeology podcast, the Seven Ages Audio Journal, and of course, news and current events without the spin on the Middle Theory podcast. You can also read my blog, find out about books I've written, and sign up for occasional newsletters that'll keep you up to date on all the things I've got happening. Plus, you can also find out where to follow me on social media. All that information and much more is found right there at MicahHanks.com. That website again is MicahHanks.com. And of course, if you enjoy what you hear on this podcast, consider sharing it with your friends. Let them know that you too are a listener of the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks program. Time for a quick UFO update before we get into this admittedly strange story from 1959. Really looking forward to covering this one with you guys, because it's very rare that I come across a story that absolutely baffles me. Let me tell you, this one does. First of all, of course, there's so much coverage in recent days of the UFO issue as it is covered here in the United States. But what about elsewhere around the world? Well, it was recently reported by abc.net.au. Again, this is actually the Australian ABC, not the one here in the United States. That's right, they report that the Royal Australian Air Force Chief says Australia has no plans to follow the Pentagon here in the U.S. by formally investigating UFOs. That's right. The RAAF chief says, apparently, that his pilots have not reported any recent sightings of unexplained objects in the sky. I mentioned Ross Coulthart on the program a while back, you know, the Australian journalist who has recently written a very good book on this topic, In Plain Sight. I wonder what Ross would have to say about that. The Royal Australian Air Force chief saying, oh, you know, our pilots, we don't see UFOs down here. Now, if that's true, indeed, it might say a lot about UFOs here in the United States and, of course, our cultural fascination with them. Many, of course, have already concluded this is primarily just a U.S. problem. This is a culture-bound phenomenon. Although, of course, from my own recent travels down to South America, I find that not to be the case. If you can still find copies of it, I recommend a book by Jim and Coral Lorenzen, the husband and wife team who back in the 50s and 60s headed the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, or APRO, and they're going to figure pretty heavily into the story of Jerry Irwin that we'll be analyzing later. But I bring them up here because in their book UFOs Over the Americas, the Lorenzens devoted quite a bit of attention to South America, especially Brazil, where I was traveling. And they would have told you back in the 60s, as I will tell you today, that there are indeed a lot of incidents from over the years involving UFOs over that part of the world, and there certainly still remains a lot of interest in the phenomenon down there today. So I wouldn't necessarily say that American pilots are the only ones that see UFOs, but it seems to be the case that a lot of American military pilots have reported seeing these things, and there could be a lot of reasons why, which we won't get into right now. But as the ABC article here goes on to report, at a Senate estimates hearing, RAAF Chief Air Marshal Mel Hupfeld was quizzed about a declassified U.S. report into the topic released in June by the U.S. Office of the Director of National Intelligence. That report, of course, we've heard about plenty here on the program, and if you go back in the archives, you can find the episode I did which provides a complete analysis of that report, what its findings were, and reading between the lines what that all actually means. However, as the ABC notes, under questioning from Greens Senator Peter Whish Wilson, the RAAF chief confirmed he was not formally aware of the report's findings, but had noticed it in the media. Air Marshal Hupfeld told the committee he had not seen any reports of unidentified aerial phenomena in Australian airspace. He said, I'm not familiar with nor have seen any reports or information regarding UAPs in an Australian airspace context, and there's no Air Force-led task force that looks into this phenomenon. He was then asked essentially whether Australia's Jindalee operational radar network could detect UAPs, and he said, it's not possible for me to determine whether the JORN would see something like an unusual airborne phenomenon without knowing the construction materials and other performance parameters of such an object, if indeed it was an object. Foreign Minister Maurice Payne later joked that it was the first time she had witnessed a parliamentary examination on the topic of UFOs. I can say with some confidence, she said, after over two decades of participating in the Senate estimates process, this is the first occasion on which, in any capacity, I have had the opportunity to observe a conversation and a question and answer session on such an issue. Now, this is really interesting to me for one primary reason. Whatever's happening here in the United States got the Australians talking about this, as we have in recent days also seen Parliament in the UK talking about this. And I'll note that the response among the Australians seems to have been very similar to that which we witnessed in the UK. We also reported that on this program. So maybe one of the biggest differences, really, in terms of the different countries and people's interest and experience with UAP has to do with how their lawmakers treat the subject. In the United Kingdom, really, there seems to have been a few who were very concerned about this. They were looking at the Pentagon report and saying, look, obviously the Americans are saying there is something to this. Other UK politicians and military officials seemingly less concerned with it, certainly less interested. And the general feeling I'm getting from the Australian report here is that the Australians were about the same. They didn't seem to have any knowledge of, interest in, or access to details about Australian experiences with UAP. Now, I put this out to the listenership, having a global audience as we do. Those of you down under who are listening to this show right now, if you have an interest in UFOs, if you have a story or a sighting you'd like to share, info@micahanks.com is the email. I want to put this out to the Australian listenership. Let me know what you have to say about this, because as important, of course, as the government's interest or involvement in a subject like this may be, I'm also really interested in hearing from the people. So let me know what's on your minds. You know, in recent days, we also got an update from Tom DeLonge of To the Stars Academy fame. And before that, of course, Angels and Airwaves and Blink-182. Yeah, rocker Tom DeLonge, who suddenly became a UFO guy. And we haven't heard all that much from Tom DeLonge since, especially, since there was a bit of a shakeup there with the To the Stars Academy, because Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon earlier this year left Tom's organization. Others, who apparently are still under contract, remain with the organization, but since Mellon and Elizondo left, who, by the way, as I now understand, have joined Avi Loeb's Galileo Project. That's the latest I have heard, so it seems that they have joined up with the Harvard astronomer who's now looking for UAP. But yes, since they left DeLonge's organization, To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences have been noticeably quiet, haven't they? And so it was interesting when the Inquirer there at Cincinnati.com did an interview with Tom DeLonge talking about his music, his new album, all kinds of things. And yes, of course, the subject of UFOs came up too. And after kind of describing the process of being ridiculed and how people had thought, oh, wow, this guy's crazy, he's giving up his career to go chase aliens. And Tom also saying, you know, that's what I signed up for. I recognize this was going to be difficult. But even after some of the setbacks from earlier this year, Tom says that now he feels people are coming back around and revisiting some of the things that he has said. He says, I'm having a lot of that happen now, but for a long time, people thought I was nuts. Again, he says, I signed up for that so it doesn't bother me. I knew what I was doing. I know what I'm doing, and I'm 1,000% confident in what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, because there's a lot more coming. I'm kind of in the front seat, he says, of a very fast-moving car that will change the world. So Tom seems to maintain that even with the departure of some of his colleagues from government, that he is still moving forward with, as he says, something that's going to change the world. He must, of course, be talking about UFOs, right? Now, something I think that we should point out here. A lot of people put so much emphasis on some of the people who have been key players. Since the formal launch of the To the Stars Academy, admittedly, Tom has said some kind of strange things, even since that became a thing, and certainly had done so before that. But if we go back and we look at the WikiLeaks email dump from 2016, where John Podesta's emails were released by WikiLeaks, we look at some of the people like Major General William McCaslin from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, who had accompanied Tom DeLonge to a meeting in Washington with John Podesta, who at that time was managing a presidential candidate's campaign. We look at the fact that there had been other people who had spoken with Tom DeLonge, people from the aerospace industry, people from within government, people who had been actively involved with, according to Tom DeLonge, helping him sanitize information about UFOs for its eventual release and public consumption. And that really seemed to have gotten underway with the formalization of the To the Stars Academy, which, with all of its ups and downs, actually, in sum total, seemed to have done little more than really produce a television show, two seasons of which aired on History. And currently, we're kind of left hanging and wondering what To the Stars Academy may do in the future involving UFOs, or if, in fact, there will be anything else. But, according to Tom DeLonge, the best is yet to come, there's still a lot on the way, and I'm going to change the world. And who knows, maybe he actually will. There are a lot of people, of course, in this field these days who like to dangle the proverbial carrot. So I'm not going to hold my breath. We'll just have to wait and see what comes down the pike. When we return after this, though, we're going to go in pursuit of a 1950s mystery involving UFOs right here on the Micah Hanks program. Imagine you're driving alone along an empty highway in the Utah desert. And suddenly a bright light streaks through the sky over you, and it descends over the horizon. A lot of things are probably going to be going through your mind. Was that an aircraft? Was it in distress? Did it actually land or did it crash? And if the latter, are there any survivors? These had been questions going through the mind of one Jerry Irwin on an evening as he drove alone through Utah and began an ordeal that would haunt him for years thereafter. Welcome back. I think, like so many other people who have come across this story, I first learned about it in a book written by Jacques Vallée called Dimensions. And toward the beginning of the second part of that book, it's presented in two parts. Fascinating read, by the way. I don't know that it would necessarily resonate with the modern, very nuts and bolts materialistic UFO researcher like it does with the more open-minded speculative Fortean, but the approach that Vallée takes in that book is essentially twofold. Maybe UFOs have been with us for a long time, and maybe they aren't extraterrestrial. And if so, and we look back in time, what kind of evidence might we look for that might represent an ongoing UFO presence throughout history? Might this phenomena we call UFOs today have been known by different names in different eras? And so Vallée is looking at mythology, ancient history, fairy folklore from the British Isles, and he begins to note some of the fairly obvious similarities between many of these traditions involving non-human intelligences as perceived by people and in different cultures throughout the world, throughout time. And he's noting some of the similarities between those past experiences and modern claims of contactees. And you've got to keep in mind, this book is essentially written just a breath after the publication of books like Communion by Whitley Strieber and Intruders by Bud Hopkins. In fact, the original edition of Dimensions by Jacques Vallée featured a foreword by Whitley Strieber. And so Vallée is very much trying to approach the UFO topic in the context of what was culturally both relevant and also of interest to UFO readers at that time, without fully stepping over into examinations of claims of alien abductees. And in this book, Vallée looks at a lot of these peculiar incidents from over the years that kind of fall on the fringes, the edges of the UFO phenomenon, where the boundary between that and the otherworldly becomes a bit blurred at times. And so with that brief bit of background in mind, it is within that context that Vallée presents the following account toward the beginning of chapter 4, where he says, "The mind of Private First Class Jerry Irwin was blank indeed when he woke up on March 2, 1959 in Cedar City Hospital. He had been unconscious for 23 hours, at times mumbling incoherently something about a jacket on the bush. When he became conscious, his first question was, 'Were there any survivors?' The story of Private Irwin is mysterious," Vallée goes on to say, "and very little has been done to clarify it. It has been mentioned only once in UFO literature by the late James Lorenzen, director of the APRO group, and has not, to the best of my knowledge, been the subject of subsequent investigation. Such an investigation," he says, "however, would throw light on the sociological context of UFO reports. Perhaps, as Lorenzen suggests, there was a military investigation that has been kept secret. If so, secrecy on the part of the authorities, if they are really concerned with a nation's peace of mind, is not the best course. The well-established facts of the Irwin case, which serves as our introduction to a discussion of the problem of contact, makes it clear that open research is now imperative on all aspects of the phenomenon." So here again, you can kind of see the context into which Vallée is putting this. Let's look at some weird cases, because really, if we're going to understand UFOs, and more importantly, if people are claiming that they are having contact with the occupants or intelligence behind them, we need to really look at all aspects of the phenomenon. In truth, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that statement. I think that's very applicable even today. With all of our tendency to focus on the nuts and bolts, and I'm no different. That aspect of it interests me too. But I do think that a broader, more holistic consideration of some of the more unusual areas related to this phenomenon from over the years should be considered. At very least, they should not be completely excluded because they don't seem to fit into a framework or a narrative that modern investigators expect to be able to operate within. But coming back to this unusual story, what exactly had attracted Vallée's attention about this? And more importantly, as he points out in Dimensions, why have so few over the years paid attention to it? I'll read just a little more here from the account that Vallée provides. As he notes, late on February 28, 1959, Jerry Irwin, a Nike missile technician, was driving from Nampa, Idaho, back to his barracks at Fort Bliss, El Paso, Texas. He had reached Cedar City, Utah, and turned southeast on Route 14. Remember that, Route 14. When he observed an unusual phenomenon 6 miles after the turnoff. According to the account Vallée gives, the landscape brightened, and a glowing object crossed the sky from right to left. Irwin stopped the car and got out. He watched the object continue to the east until hidden from view by a ridge. Just underscoring how much interest this account has managed to generate over the years, and yet, despite that, until fairly recently, very little additional historical investigation into it has been conducted. Here in my very own hardcover copy of Dimensions, someone with a pencil had actually gone into the margins and had highlighted certain portions of passages recounting this case. Obviously, the original owner of this book was no less interested in it. The witness, Vallée goes on to write, decided that he might have seen an airliner on fire attempting a forced landing, in which case there was no time to lose. Consequently, instead of resuming his journey, Irwin wrote a note. That note read as follows: "Have gone to investigate possible plane crash. Please call law enforcement officers." And he places that on the steering wheel of his car. Then, using shoe polish, he writes "stop" on the side of his car. This in order to make sure that people would find his note. And then he starts out on foot. That's right, Jerry Irwin, after leaving notes about where he's headed, what he intends to do, and also a note scribbled in shoe polish on the side of his vehicle to flag down any motorists who might come along and see his car parked there, Jerry sets off on foot into the snow in pursuit of answers to what he had just seen streaking through the sky overhead. Although little did he know, as Jerry Irwin slammed the car door and set off on foot that night, that the path that he was walking would lead him not only into the heart of mystery, mystery which remains unsolved, but would also lead to questions that would haunt him for decades. More about this perplexing case when we return, right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. So what happened to Jerry Irwin in 1959? What was the object he saw? What caused the health problems he would begin to experience shortly thereafter? Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll get back into that here in a moment. First, I want to remind you, if you enjoy this podcast and you aren't already an ex-subscriber, you're only getting half the story. In fact, over the weekend, we just dropped our latest edition of Enigmas, the monthly special that goes out, but there is the weekly additional X podcast that subscribers get every single week. So definitely check out MicahHanks.com/podcast. And there in the upper right-hand corner of the page, you'll see the link to X memberships where you can subscribe. Although, right there from your podcasting app, just open the show notes and scroll down. You'll see the X memberships link there as well. Definitely Consider supporting this program and getting a little something extra to show for it. Our ex-subscribers are really what keep this operation afloat. And with the holidays right around the corner, I do want to remind you also that if you would like to advertise on the Micah Hanks program, you can do that also. We have information about how to advertise right there in the show notes as well. Just open your podcasting app, click the link, and that'll put you in contact with who handles our sponsorships. Of course, you can also contact me and anybody else out there who has information they want to share or an idea, feedback they want to send along. You can email me directly, info@micahhanks.com. I'll certainly be glad to hear from you. And so now, getting back into this story, I want to refer now to a newspaper article that appeared on February 21st, 1959 in the Deseret News and Telegram. Under the rather curious heading, Iron Police, Puzzled by Unconscious Man. They aren't talking about the police being strongman competitors, by the way. They're talking about the name of the county in question, but as the article details for us, Iron County officials had a mystery on their hands Saturday after finding an unconscious 23-year-old Idaho man lying face down in the mud Friday night, about a quarter mile from his car on U-20 near Cedar City. I'll note, by the way, they mentioned U-20 is where this man was found. Keep that in mind. Earlier, you may have noticed a different highway was named, and that all will begin to come into focus a bit later. But as the article notes, the young man, identified as Bernard G. Irwin, 1919 3rd Street, North Nampa, Idaho, was brought into Iron County Hospital at about midnight. An attending physician could find no apparent injuries, but the man could not be revived to talk. The mystery began about 8 p.m. when Saunders Clark of the State Fish and Game Commission was driving along U-20 and saw a parked car with the word STOP written on it in shoe polish. So far, so good, right? We've heard this much of the story. He found a note in the car which read, "Have gone to investigate what looks like a plane crash about one quarter mile to my right. Notify state police immediately." It was signed Bernard G. Irwin. Using his two-way radio, Mr. Clark called Sheriff Otto Fife in Cedar City for help. After checking and finding that there was a plane reported missing, the sheriff sent deputies and an ambulance to the scene. Meanwhile, an Ernest Cavanaugh of Anaheim, California, who was a truck driver, and four men in another car, Vance Underwood from Kenosha, Jerry Underwood, Jones Maxwell, and Burnell Thomas, all of Eureka, came by the parked car and stopped. By the way, you got a note that everyone whose name appears in this article also has their town of origin listed. In Jerry Irwin's case, they actually gave his home address. This was the 1950s, folks. But as they note, while Mr. Clark waited at the scene, the others followed footprints in the snow for about a quarter of a mile, where they found the unconscious youth lying face down in the dirt. Now just imagine if you're one of these men who is in this sort of makeshift search and rescue crew. You're driving along, and you see a guy who turns out to be essentially a game warden, waving down traffic and saying, "We've got a man who's gone up this hill looking for a crashed plane. I need somebody to help me go up here and look for this guy." And so you, not knowing what else to do, or really being given any other alternatives, you get out of the car with your buddies, and you follow this guy up the hill, following footsteps left by a man who left notes scribbled on paper and in shoe polish on his car, claiming that a plane has just crashed and he's going to try and help him. So you don't know what to expect. You may end up actually being part of a rescue mission, either for a crashed aircraft or for a guy who might have gone missing looking for one. And then you find this otherwise seemingly healthy 23-year-old Air Force serviceman laying face down on the ground, completely unconscious. That's where we are right now. That's where these unassuming passers-by found themselves on that February evening in 1959. Unable, then, to revive Mr. Irwin, they're like, "We've got to keep this guy warm until real help arrives." So, and I return now to the article, they started a fire to keep him warm until the ambulance arrived to take him to the hospital. Sheriff Fife said Saturday that papers that had been found in his vehicle, apparently signed by his commanding officer, indicated that he was due back at his base on Friday. The sheriff also said that a check made with the CAA-3 after the youth was found showed that the plane, which had been missing, had reported in safely in Arizona. A later check of all air facilities, including those in Salt Lake City, indicated no missing planes over Utah. Now think about this for a moment. This was the early stages, maybe hours after this young man was found. We know that he had seen something in the sky because he says he thinks a plane has gone down in the note that he left behind in his vehicle. And so they're checking to try and find out if there are any missing planes, and indeed there was a plane that might have been considered missing initially, but it reports safely after it lands in Arizona. No other aircraft are missing in the region, and so they can't account for any missing aircraft that would corroborate with what this young man said, that he went up the hill in search of that night, and thereafter was mysteriously discovered unconscious, laying face down on the ground, and rescued by a group of ranked strangers who built a fire to keep him warm. Quite a weird story. And of course, there was additional reporting on this incident that appeared in the newspapers in the days that followed, because as we will learn, shortly after he regained consciousness after being admitted to a local hospital, Mr. Irwin did give a statement to Sheriff Fife there in Iron County. We'll come back around to that later. At this point, though, I actually want to skip ahead to a short synopsis of the case, which actually will fill in some of those additional details about what happened in the days after he is admitted to the hospital. And this appeared in March 1959 in the APRO Bulletin. Remember, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization headed by Jim and Coral Lorenzen. This is how they described the circumstances in their March 1959 edition of the APRO Bulletin, under an article titled, "Soldier Sees Flash Unconscious for 24 Hours. A mysterious flash in the sky, which PFC Bernard G. Irwin of Fort Bliss, Texas, thought was a plane crash and set out to investigate, was possibly the cause of his unconscious state for the next 24 hours. On the evening of the 22nd of February, Irwin, who was en route to Fort Bliss via a shortcut in southern Utah after a furlough to his home in Nampa, Idaho, stopped on a small highway after seeing what he thought was a plane crash. He wrote the word stop on his car with shoe polish to attract other motorists, then wrote a note to explain where he had gone." Here again, so far so good. The article continues, "Later a Utah Fish and Game Department agent saw the car and the sign and stopped to read the note. He summoned police and a search was begun. Shortly, Irwin was found lying face down in the mud, unconscious. He did not awaken until 24 hours later on Saturday evening." Now that essentially brings us up to where we are now with this case. And the Lorenzens give us the following details. Doctors who treated him and observed him at Cedar City, Utah, where he was taken by the police, said that he had no visible marks or wounds, which would account for his state of unconsciousness. According to press reports, Irwin could shed no light on what had happened to him. The note read, "Have gone to investigate what looks like a plane crash about 1/4 mile to my right. Notify state police immediately." That much also jives with what we've already heard. Continuing with the Lorenzen's account, the press in their reports said flash in the sky. Irwin's note said what looks like a plane crash. Now you can see, of course, being the ground team at the APRO headquarters that the Lorenzens were, they are narrowing in on what the object might have been that he had seen in the sky. "Investigation indicates," they wrote, "there was no plane crash, none whatsoever, and therefore it must be assumed that Irwin saw something else." "A meteor," they ask. "If remains of such had been found, it certainly would have been noted, but it wasn't." Well, on 12th of March, I called PFC Irwin at his duty location in Fort Bliss and asked him numerous questions about his adventure. Irwin had no explanation of what happened, but a more complete picture of the actual incident was obtained. Irwin said he saw the light coming toward the ground, and it appeared to land about 1/4 mile from where he was. He thought it was a plane crash, although he heard no sound to identify it as such. The light was very bright and had a shape, but not definite. When it came to ground, it flared up and then died out completely. Now that is an interesting account. This is based on what Irwin told the Lorenzens in a phone call. And this phone call, of course, occurred on March 12th. So keep that in mind, too. The soldier, who is a 23-year-old volunteer, said he was walking up the hill and does not know when or where he blacked out. When he came to 24 hours later in the Cedar City Hospital, he was talking about jacket on the bush, but doesn't know why he mentioned it. There is one important point, however, and that is the fact that Irwin was wearing, besides the normal clothing, a sports jacket and an overcoat buttoned over it. He had it on when he left his car, and said that his overcoat was on and buttoned when he got to the hospital, according to hospital attendants, but that his jacket was missing. The jacket was just simply not on him when he was undressed by attendants at the hospital. Nor was it found during the air and ground search, nor was it in the car. Now, in other words, Jerry had recently bought a new sports jacket, which he was wearing, but he also had his military jacket on over that. It was cold again. There was snow on the ground, as the account reads. So he's got these double layers of jackets, but when they find him laying face down, he's apparently only wearing the military jacket. Now, of course, we have to imagine that if he's got the military jacket on, which had been the outermost layer of clothing he'd been wearing, if that's still on him, but he is now missing the jacket that he had underneath that, both jackets at some point must have come off of him and one must have been put back onto him. Now, why would he be missing one jacket? Now, I'll add here that when you look at missing person cases, especially involving people in cold weather temperatures, there is a peculiar phenomenon that can tend to occur. And this is something that David Politis of Missing 411 fame and a lot of people who look at strange disappearances and things like this, missing persons cases, search and rescue stuff, they will note this peculiar phenomenon. It is where in cold weather people will begin shedding clothing. And the presumed mechanism behind this is that when people are lost, they're disoriented, they begin to get dehydrated, and in some cases they may even begin to experience the onset of frostbite. It can create the sensation of being very hot rather than being frigid cold, and so in some instances, people who are missing in cold climes have been known to have been found by search and rescuers later having removed some of their clothing, which is the last thing you'd think someone would do in a cold environment like this. Now, in Mr. Irwin's case, this is a little different, because he hadn't been missing for very long. That much we seem to know, right? I mean, we know where he was coming from, where he was headed to. The game and fish officer sees his car, finds the note. At this point, they wouldn't have even been sure if Irwin was quote-unquote missing. For all they knew, he had actually just gone up there, and they were going to follow him up the hill and find a plane crash and see him pulling people out of the wreckage. They didn't know what to expect. He certainly hadn't been missing for days, probably wasn't dehydrated and disoriented. And so they follow him up the hill, and instead of finding a plane crash, they find this young man laying face down, completely unconscious, and presumably, the people who find him, they're not going to know that he's missing a jacket. But as they take him to the hospital, and he's gradually coming to, he mumbles something about jacket on bush. And then when he fully comes to in the hospital, the first thing he says is, were there any survivors? So he doesn't seem to remember whether there was an actual plane crash or not. The last thing he recalls was going up there trying to find the plane crash, and he's still asking, were there any survivors? Presumably it's at this time that he mentions, yeah, I had had another jacket on. Was I not wearing that when you guys found me? What happened? Now, coming back to the analysis provided by the Lorenzans in their article, and actually I think it had been Coral who wrote this, there was an initial write-up by her, and then sometime later her husband Jim wrote a lengthier article that the APRO also published, but I think we're getting the investigation initially from March 1959 as written up by Coral Lorenzan, and she said, it can be theorized that the jacket was stolen. But by whom and when, except during the period that he was lying unconscious near that lonely road? As she notes, my conversation with Irwin also brought out the fact that Irwin was given a complete physical checkup at Cedar City and was found to be a very normal, healthy young man. He has no history of neurosis or blacking out spells. PFC Irwin was flown to William Beaumont Army Hospital by the Army and underwent a 4-day psychiatric and medical examination and observation by Army doctors, who also found him to be normal, according to Irwin. I asked him if he had any troubles or anxieties which he felt might have caused the blackout, and Irwin answered that he had had none that he could think of. However, several days after he had returned to normal routine at Fort Bliss, Irwin did suffer a fainting spell during his off-duty hours. No evident physical reason for this, either. Now, of course, this initial write-up and the later one that would be featured again in APRO publications by Jim Lorenzan had served as the basis of the sole investigation referenced earlier by Jacques Vallée, as mentioned in his book Dimensions, where he's talking about the one time that a UFO investigative group looked at this case. And on that note, I'll now return to the account that Vallée gives us in the late 1980s when he revisits the case And here he is basically only working off of the information that had been published by APRO at the various times that they covered this case. As Vallée notes, at the hospital, Dr. Broadbent observed that Irwin's temperature and respiration were normal. He seemed merely asleep, but he could not be awakened. Dr. Broadbent diagnosed hysteria. Then, when Irwin did wake up, he felt fine, although he was still puzzled by the object he had seen. He was also puzzled by the disappearance of his jacket. He was assured that he was not wearing it when he was found by the search party. Irwin was flown back to Fort Bliss and placed under observation at William Beaumont Army Hospital for 4 days, after which period he returned to duty. His security clearance, however, was revoked. Now, that might seem strange, but it probably wasn't, because, again, this young man seemingly has this episode, and his superior officers are probably thinking, you know, for the time being, until we determine why this guy was found laying face down, unconscious, and thereafter ended up being hospitalized, and we don't know what happened to him, until we find out, it might not be a good idea to have this guy managing Nike missiles, right? That might be a security issue. Well, several days later, Vallée tells us, Irwin fainted while walking in the camp, but he recovered rapidly. Several days after that, on Sunday, March 15th, he fainted again in an El Paso street and was taken to Southwest General Hospital. There, his physical condition was found similar to that observed in Cedar City. He woke up at 2 a.m. on Monday and asked, were there any survivors? Now, keep in mind, this is not the same series of events that we had already previously heard. We're talking about him waking up after fainting again on March 15th. As he walked down an El Paso street, he's hospitalized. He wakes up the following Monday at 2 a.m., and as he had asked immediately upon awaking, following the original scenario from back in February, he asks, were there any survivors? Well, he was told that the date was not February 28th, but March 16th. Once more, Irwin was then taken to William Beaumont Hospital and placed under observation by psychiatrists. He remained there for over 1 month. Lorenzen reports that, according to a Captain Valentine, the results of the tests indicated that Irwin was normal. He was discharged from the hospital on April 17th. Now, here's where things start to get really strange. The next day, following a very powerful urge, he left the fort without leave, caught a bus in El Paso, arrived in Cedar City Sunday afternoon, April 19th, reportedly walked to the spot where he had seen the object, left the road, and went back through the hills right to a bush where his jacket lay. According to Valet's account, based on the earlier April account, there was a pencil in a buttonhole with a piece of paper wound tightly around it. He took the paper and burned it. Now, I'll mention again, in the old hardcover copy of Dimensions I have here, burned it is underlined, and then in the margin, somebody drew a question mark. They're wondering, what happened here? Then he seemed to come out of a trance. He had to look for the road, not understanding why he had come out here. He turned himself in and thus met Sheriff Otto Fife, who gave him the details of the first incident. Remember, he had provided an account to Sheriff Otto Fife previously. Shortly after the original incident, he meets him again. He's unclear about what exactly is going on, seemingly suffering from amnesia, and the sheriff says, son, I've met you before, this is what happened. Well, the Lorenzens contacted Irwin after he had returned to Fort Bliss and undergone a new psychological examination, as futile as the previous one. His case came to the attention of the Inspector General, who ordered a new investigation. On July 10th, Irwin re-entered the hospital. On August 1st, he failed to report for duty. 1 month later, he was listed as a deserter. He was never seen again. That is essentially where Vallée's account left this story. Quite a cliffhanger, huh? And for all anybody knew at that point, Jerry Irwin seemed to have just vanished into the mists of time. But of course, as we're about to hear, that had not in fact been the case. One researcher, having read the account Vallée gave, decided that he would try to find Mr. Irwin, and he did. He even went to his house and spoke with him about what happened. And we're going to cover that and much more about this perplexing case when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. So what happened to Jerry Erwin? That's the question that's been on my mind recently, no doubt. It's on yours now, too. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. You know, Dimensions by Jacques Vallée is now available on audiobook. And although I've owned a copy for many years, I got that audiobook so that I could revisit some of Vallée's writing, you know, when I'm driving around town, running errands, things like that. One reason I love audiobooks, although I don't feel like I can quite retain the information from just listening to a book compared with actually reading it, I still like to read rather than merely being read to. And I don't know why necessarily that story didn't stick out to me years ago when I first read it like it did in recent days, hearing the narrative version. And it really kind of struck me, yeah, maybe it would be worth looking into this case, seeing if there was anything else that ever turned up about Jerry Erwin. And lo and behold, apparently somebody else had the same question. A Mr. David Boer of Southern Wisconsin, who a few years ago decided that he was going to try and follow up on this story. And not only was he able to track down a bunch of articles and find additional information, not only was he able to obtain military records of Jerry Erwin, not only was he able to obtain original commentary and even notes and correspondence from Jim and Coral Lorenzen. No, David Boer, who, as I understand it, had only had an interest in this kind of topic and had never really conducted any kind of historical investigations regarding UFOs of his own, he decides to try and see what he can find about Jerry Erwin, and lo and behold, he tracks the guy down. He finds him with the help of his local librarian. All you budding researchers out there, back in the old days, back before there was an internet, researchers had to go to their libraries to be able to get access to periodicals and other publications that helped them conduct research. UFO investigators, when they wanted to be able to go and look at old newspapers, they actually had to travel. They had to go into these musty basements of old newspaper repositories and try and dig through back issues and try and find information about UFOs. Now, just imagine that process for a moment. I don't want to digress too much here. But nowadays, we've got search engines. We've got newspapers.com, right? I can go on newspapers.com. I can find an article simply by doing keyword searches. Back in the old days, researchers had to go into the basement of the New York Times, and they had to go through every single issue. Even if they had a general idea of the time frame of something that they were looking for information about, they still had to actually read the paper. They had to scan through it and see if there had been anything reported. They didn't just have the luxury of doing keyword searches like you or I could do. And nowadays, instead of having a library card, everybody's got a smartphone in their pocket that gives them access to the world's largest library. The worldwide internet, which is really the greatest summary of all human knowledge that's ever been produced. You know, anybody can access that these days, and if you don't have a smartphone or an internet connection, you can still go to your library and use a computer there and get access. Well, as it turns out, David Boer, when he decided to begin researching this strange case, and all he had to go off of essentially was what Vallée had written and what other articles he was able to turn up in his own historical research, yeah, he goes and talks to his local librarian who is able to get access to information and finds out that Jerry Erwin, or at least somebody under the same name with the same peculiar spelling, by the way, he spells it with a G, not a J, so it's G, Jerry, Erwin with an I, not an E. There's somebody under that name who's still alive and well in his 80s. And so David Boer, out of the blue, calls him and talks to him on the telephone. And throughout the course of that and other conversations, as well as additional historical research he carried out, this all culminated in a book that Boer authored in 2017 called No Return, The Jerry Erwin Story, UFO Abduction or Covert Operation. And let me tell you, having read Mr. Boer's book, which, as always, I'll have linked in the show notes for anybody else who is interested, and I highly recommend it. It's a good read. But the story is as strange as he makes it out to be in the title of the book. I want to quote Mr. Boer now from a brief excerpt in that book where he describes reaching out to Jerry Erwin after having found him with the help of his local librarian. He says, quote, "I made the phone call to Jerry's home in Idaho. After our greetings, I asked Jerry if he had ever seen the articles that were written about him. I never read or saw anything, he replied in his backcountry drawl. Oh, really? I asked. No, he said, and after that one incident, I went to Germany and spent a lot of time over there in the military. And I went to Austria, and I finally came home, you know. I never got any information. They wouldn't tell me much. Boer says, I was about to read one of the stories I had about him when, for the first time, he told me the story in his own words. And this is the brief synopsis that Jerry Irwin, alive and in his 80s, gives to Boer over the telephone. He says, I was en route back to my house. I had been on leave up here in Idaho, and I was on my way back to Fort Bliss, Texas, and I was driving at night, and what I first recall was that I saw something like a falling star, but it was real close, and it appeared to, you know, to hit. I stopped the car, and I was going to go over to see what that was, and evidently I passed out because somebody found me and I was unconscious. In other words, somebody, you know, I put my blinkers on, and I was just walking over there, and I thought whatever it was hit or landed. I had no idea. And then I woke up in a hospital, and I was just told that some people had stopped and had notified local authorities and something was going on. They had no idea. And they found me, and I was unconscious. And I ended up back at Fort Bliss, Texas. They transported me back there, and they run a bunch of tests and stuff, but they never told me results of anything I told them. They put some sort of drug and put you out, and it's like a truth serum. And I couldn't recall what I said or who asked me what. They wouldn't say anything about it. And that was just about the only thing I remember of it. And then later I got transferred over to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. So that's how Jerry Irwin, back in 2013, apparently when Boer reached out to him, that's how he remembered what happened back in 1959. Still had at least some memory of events, but he couldn't seem to recall specifics, and further said, hey, nobody really told me anything. I just woke up in the hospital. And then they reassigned me, I was sent to Kansas, and then thereafter off to Austria and Germany and spent some time over there. Now, it's kind of peculiar that this is all that Irwin seems to recall, although we must remember, shortly after he returns down there to Texas, he passes out, but he recovers pretty quickly, and then he's walking down a street in El Paso, passes out again, ends up being hospitalized for a while, wakes up the following Monday, and at this point he's still asking, were there any survivors? So in other words, Jerry Irwin had seemingly been suffering from some memory loss, and evidently, decades later, when David Boer tracks him down, he still has a fairly spotty memory. This is all I recall. I don't remember reading anything about it after the fact, he says. Well, over the next few weeks and months, Boer continues to talk with Irwin and actually makes arrangements to go to his house and visit with him, so he does. He travels over there, and he actually meets with him in his home, sits down and interviews him. And he notices that at times some inconsistencies and even contradictions do appear in the story that Jerry tells, but he says, I don't think that this was deception. He said it seemed very evident that Jerry had trouble remembering things. Like he would tell me one thing, and then maybe in another conversation he would say something that he had claimed he didn't know before, and I would point it out, and he would say, did I say that? And he said he seemed genuinely perplexed. And even confused at times. I didn't get the impression, in other words, that this guy was just feeding me a line, that this was a story. But now, if you recall, in the account that Jacques Vallée gave us in his book Dimensions, he tells us that apparently after his second hospitalization, Jerry then takes a bus back to Cedar City, and he hikes several miles up Highway 14 back to the location where the incident occurred, and he finds his jacket. And not only is his jacket still hanging on a bush, apparently, as he had seemingly described while coming in and out of consciousness at the hospital, he kept saying jacket on bush, is what they said. And this even recounted in some of the earlier reports appearing in the newspapers. Well, in the middle of March, after his second hospitalization, almost in a trance-like state, Irwin reportedly catches a bus, goes to Cedar City, hikes up there into the mountains, finds the location where his jacket is hanging. And not only that, but there's also a note wrapped around a pencil, which he removes, and without reading the note, he burns. According to the story, Irwin is somewhat revived, brought back to his senses by the smell of the smoke as he's burning this note, and then realizes, hey, wait, where am I exactly? And Irwin doesn't apparently know where he is. And it was at this point, according to Vallée's narrative, that he ends up having to turn himself in, where he meets for the second time Iron County Sheriff Fife, who says, well, you actually already have met me, and you gave me a statement last month about what happened to you then when we found you laying face down up there off of highway, well, what was it? Was it Highway 14, or was it, like in those early articles, was it U-20? This is another one of the issues that Boer found when he began looking into this story, and it may seem like a minor point. Well, somebody just got one of the facts wrong. They wrote down the wrong name of the highway. But this is a pretty complicated issue because all of the early articles, including the one that we referenced earlier, they mention it as being U-20. Whereas every account that the Lorenzans wrote said it was Highway 14. And thereafter, of course, Vallée's account also says Highway 14 because he is following the lead of the Lorenzans, having referenced their articles from the April Bulletin. And as Boer points out in his book, the problem with this is that Highway 14 is essentially accessible from right there in the middle of Cedar City, so there's no problem with Irwin having caught a bus to Cedar City and then being dropped off in the middle of town, and then following Highway 14 6 miles up into the mountains and going to the location where he found his jacket. Nothing wrong with that part of the narrative. However, to have gotten up to U-20, where the early articles say that the original incident actually happened, he couldn't have just walked a few miles up into the hills and spent an afternoon on foot. It would have taken him a couple of days to walk all the way up to the location that the original accounts in the newspapers had said that he had been found. So something obviously doesn't add up. How could his jacket have been found off Highway 14, but he had been found lying face down, near where his car was parked, mind you, off of U-20? And so that leads to a number of considerations. Had the newspapers all been wrong? I mean, would all of the newspaper writers at the time of the incident have somehow managed to completely get the facts wrong and report it as being on an entirely different highway than the one where it actually happened? Another consideration, had Jim and Coral Lorenzen possibly been wrong? What if Irwin himself had been mistaken? Could he have been wrong? I mean, we have to take into consideration he seems to have been suffering from several fainting spells and obvious memory loss around that time. So could he have just been mistaken about where he said he went? And then finally, with all these inconsistencies taken into consideration, some would argue, well, this seems to point to a hoax, because when the facts don't line up and we can't seem to reconcile the issue, then that probably points to deception. However, unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be quite as clear-cut as that. And when we come back, before we wrap things up, I want to come back around to the original account that was provided to Sheriff Fife, which certainly may provide some more tantalizing details. And we'll also look at what David Boer's research seems to have suggested about what actually happened to Jerry Irwin. All that and more when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. Rounding out this conversation about really one of the strangest incidents possibly involving a UFO that I've come across in recent memory. Again, the book that details the research of David Boer into this long-standing mystery is called No Return, The Jerry Irwin Story. I'll have that linked in the show notes. This was published by Anomalous Books, and of course they are one of the better publishers that looks at these kinds of issues today. Patrick Wiege, a longtime purveyor of Fortiana, and in addition to publishing a lot of original titles, Patrick has also made sure that some classics, including, incidentally, Dimensions by Jacques Vallée, he's made sure that those remain in print and available to readers of the modern generation. And I think it's really important, by the way, that people who have begun studying UFOs and have become experts since 2017, and they have YouTube channels, and they've got blogs, and what have you, but they've never read anything beyond what happened in 2004 to the Navy servicemen and women who were part of the Nimitz Carrier Group, and that now famous incident that occurred there. Yeah, for people who think that the UFO phenomena started in 2004, I would say, yeah, you should go back and read some of these earlier books, and look at some of the case histories that support the idea that there's been a phenomenon at least since around the Second World War. Again, I'll reference also last week's fine conversation that we had with researcher Graeme Rendell talking about the Foo Fighters. And for ex-subscribers over the weekend, we went a little further back. Of course, I do that frequently on this show, though, because it's important to look at the history behind this phenomenon. And that's really primarily what kind of drew my attention to the Jerry Irwin story, because if this story is new to you, as you're probably beginning to see, something happened. Something happened to Jerry Irwin that caused him to faint and to lose some of his memory shortly after seeing a strange object flying through the sky. And what's really interesting about that is, of course, by today's standards, many people would say, well, maybe he was abducted, right? But there hadn't been stories of alien abductions in 1959 that were well known. Now, there had been a case in Brazil involving a man named Antonio Vilas Boas. He was a farmer who claimed that he was taken aboard an aircraft, and instead of being subjected to poking and probing and prodding, no, he basically was disrobed and put into a room into which, shortly thereafter, he was joined by a blonde, beautiful, and similarly disrobed female, and Mr. Vilas Boas says that essentially nature took its course, as one might expect. After which, he was given his clothes back, given a tour of the ship, and then put back in the farmer's field where they'd picked him up, and then the object rose into the heavens and sped off like a bullet. Well, many years later, Antonio would claim that, according to his sister as she remembered it, people from NASA came to Brazil, brought Mr. Vilas Boas back to the United States against his will. They questioned him about the incident. They showed him an aircraft and asked if the one that he saw was similar. He described it as being a flying saucer. But some researchers have noted that if you actually read the account that he gave of the object, he described this sort of spinning cupola over a egg-shaped portion, and that it kind of produced this pulsing noise. It sounded a lot like a helicopter, what he described. Well, one of the Brazilian correspondents for the Lorenzans had actually interviewed Mr. Vilas Boas shortly after this happened. And he sent a report back to Jim and Coral Lorenzen, who thought it was an interesting story, but they didn't publish it for pretty obvious reasons, because keep in mind it is the 1950s, and here's this guy who claims he's taken aboard a flying saucer, his clothes are taken from him, and he's given the time of his life, and then a tour of the inside of the spaceship, which he curiously described as resembling a helicopter, as though he had never seen a helicopter before, but in fact, maybe he hadn't. Who knows? But the point is, it was a weird story, and so the Lorenzans didn't publish it. But they knew about it. And so when Jerry Irwin's story comes on the radar, now we begin to see really why they were so interested. He says he sees a bright light passing overhead. They find him unconscious. He gets back to the hospital, and he's asking about his jacket. And they say, well, you were just wearing your military jacket. And he said, no, I had another one on underneath that. So what happened to the other jacket, which of course would have required the removal of the first outer layer jacket before the second one could be removed and then, well, apparently lost? These details, of course, were not lost on the Lorenzans, who were like, okay, it seems that he'd had some clothing removed. They find him passed out. He doesn't have a full memory of what happened. Could this guy have been taken aboard the craft like this farmer fellow from down there in Brazil? Now, of course, for this case to have met all that criteria, the object that Mr. Irwin had seen would have had to have been a UFO, right? It couldn't have just been an aircraft that went down. And as David Boer began to find as he was doing additional research, statements from doctors, according to military records and the like, seemed to indicate that Irwin had described what he had seen as a plane, which he believed had crashed, and this was even stated in the original note that he placed in his vehicle, and he continued to say that he had thought that there had been a plane crash to his medical caregivers, but apparently some of his bunkmates back at base had said that he described what he saw as being more akin to a flying saucer. Now you add to that also the fact that UFO researcher Loren Gross, who was an amateur historical researcher into the UFO phenomenon and who produced and self-published all these really pretty good histories documenting UFO developments, and did so, interestingly, up until the Betty and Barney Hill case, the first widely recognized abduction, actually did arrive on the scene, because at that point, for Gross, he said it really began to kind of change the dynamic of the UFO topic. But those early histories that he wrote really are still seen as being invaluable to modern researchers as far as the history of the phenomenon. And it had been Loren Gross who had actually obtained not one but two letters from Sheriff Fife of Iron County, which provided his recollection of the early account given to him in the original witness statement from Jerry Irwin upon having woken up in the hospital there in late February 1959. I want to reference one of those letters from Sheriff Fife, which David Boer also features in his book, because this really provides some interesting additional details. According to Sheriff Fife, he said, "With regards to your request for a report on Bernard G. Irwin," he says, "I will tell you the story as he told it to me. Mr. Irwin was returning to Fort Bliss, Texas from his home in Nampa, Idaho. He was going south on U.S. Highway 91, and he decided to go over the range of mountains east to Highway 89. The state highway number 20 connects these two U.S. highways and is located about 40 miles north of Cedar City. It was dusk on the evening of February 20th, 1959, and about 5 miles into the mountains that Mr. Irwin saw a large object flying from south to north almost directly overhead. He thought it was an airplane, but couldn't tell the shape on account of the streams of light shooting out from it. He said it was very large, and on account of the light radiating from it, he thought it was on fire. He drove up the road for a few hundred yards and turned around and came back to the place where the object had flown over him. He could see the light to the north shining up into the sky and thought the plane had crashed and was burning." Now, we'll come back to Sheriff Fife's letter here in a moment, but I mean, this is a really interesting account that he gives, because presumably this is how he recalled it, and maybe if he actually took notes during the statement that was provided by Jerry Irwin, Fife may have even been referring to notes that he took at that time, but in any case, what he says is, "This is the story as I recall Irwin telling me," which would have occurred right after he came to, shortly after being hospitalized, after they find him passed out there off the side of the road. And Irwin had told Fife this object was pretty large, it gave off a lot of light, and that Irwin had traveled on down the road a ways before he turns around, goes back up to take a second look, and can see the light shining up into the sky. In other words, based on this account, whatever the object was that Irwin had seen, he thought it had either landed or crashed, but whatever it was still producing light. And so he actually decides to park his car, and we know the rest of the story from this point. He leaves the notes and heads up the hill to investigate. Now, at this point, I want to come back to Fife's letter. He says, "At this point, Mr. Irwin wrote a note, left it on his car, stating that he had gone to investigate a plane crash. He started to climb the steep mountain in about a foot of snow, and the closer he came to the top of the hill, the brighter the light became. He figured the plane had crashed just over the top of the hill, and he would be able to see it from the top. As he reached the top of the hill, he blacked out and was out for about 23 hours. Now, you got to keep in mind, he hadn't been hiking for very long as he's approaching the top of this hill, on the other side of which he can see this light. He can't see what's producing the light, but he knows something's producing light on the other side of the hill. And before he gets to the top, he blacks out. And he remains blacked out for 23 hours. Mind you, he doesn't remain there. He is recovered shortly thereafter by the game and fish officer and a group of passersby, truck drivers who aid in a makeshift search and rescue operation. They go up there, they find Mr. Irwin. He's passed out. He's taken to the hospital, and 23 hours thereafter, he regains full consciousness. And the first thing he asks, "Were there any survivors?" So he seemingly never saw what was on the other side of that hill. Sheriff Fife's letter goes on to give additional details that are already familiar to us by now, but again, I want to emphasize that last passage we featured from his note, which seems to give the best description as Jerry remembered it immediately upon awakening, of his last memories before blacking out. So what does all this really mean? Well, what this conveys to us is that there was obviously something up there on the other side of this hill that was producing light. So maybe the Lorenzans and APRO were justified in thinking that this was probably a UFO incident. Something had gone down, but we know it wasn't an airplane, right? Now, had it just been a meteor, it seems rather unlikely that it would have landed on the ground and still produced light for several minutes at least, but really, who knows how long? It really depends on how long it was between the time that Jerry saw the object pass overhead and then go down, out of view, and then him turning around, parking the car, writing the note, and heading up the hill. However long that might have lasted, minutes, an hour, who knows, this object was able to produce light for that long. Probably not just a meteor. And if it wasn't a meteor, and we know it wasn't a missing aircraft that had crashed, what then was the flying object that produced that light? And that, in fact, remains a valid question. Now, for ex-subscribers, I'm going to go a little deeper into all of this. I highly recommend, of course, that you check out David Boer's book, No Return, The Jerry Irwin Story. The book is, in my opinion, a fantastic representation of historical detective work, and it definitely does provide some additional details about this case that, for all valet or anyone else had known as recently as the 1980s, you know, this all happened, and then this guy goes AWOL and disappears, was never seen again. As Boer later learns, yeah, apparently Mr. Irwin did desert, he did leave for a while. He wrote a bad check and took his paycheck and also the money he collected from the bad check. As best as he could remember, he took a bus back to Idaho, and he hid out in the woods for almost 3 months. When Boer asked Irwin during their interviews in 2013 what he'd been doing during that period he was missing, Irwin apparently told Boer, "I was up in the hills having the time of my life." He'd been fishing, hunting, camping, but eventually it comes onto his radar that local law enforcement knows he's up there somewhere in the Idaho backwoods, and they're looking for him because apparently he's a deserter. And so he turns himself in, according to his own account. According to the official military records, he was actually apprehended by law enforcement. He's thereafter sent to Fort Lewis, Washington, and based on documents retrieved by Boer, he actually becomes the subject of a general court-martial trial. That's the highest form of court-martial there is. And he was actually sentenced thereafter to hard labor, no pay, and sometime thereafter he was reassigned and then sent to Austria and Germany, and had little recollection of the events from early 1959. But before we wrap up, I do want to point out, emphasize in fact, that as Boer reveals in the book, he's able to get access to some military records, he's also able to get access to some of Jim and Coral Lorenzen's actual files, and despite some of the inconsistencies and things that are noted, the discrepancies between the Lorenzen's account and what appeared in the newspapers back in February and March of 59, what is clear is that Jerry Irwin was absolutely found under the conditions as described in those newspaper reports. He did maintain, and to this day, presumably still maintains, that he saw something that he said, "I kind of look like a meteor, but it was really bright." And as Sheriff Fife's account seems to describe, it remained bright while it sat there on the ground on the other side of the hill from him, leading him to think it had been a crashed airplane. Now, some people who have looked at the hoax angle on all this would say, well, he was already obviously late getting back to base, and so he might have cooked up this story as a cover. Now, I would have to say to that, that makes no sense at all. If you're already late, why, as your cover story, are you going to cook up a story about seeing a UFO and then pretend to black out? But keep in mind, even if we were to try and stretch our minds around the idea that Mr. Irwin had faked being unconscious for 23 hours, all the people who were involved in the rescue, all the caregivers at the hospital, they all attest to the fact that they couldn't find anything wrong with him, but he definitely seemed to be unconscious. But then, with his subsequent hospitalizations and his memory lapses, the Lorenzens begin to suspect something else might be going on. And the APRO files, which David Boer actually was able to get copies of, that include correspondences with no less an authority than Carl Jung himself. That's right, Coral Lorenzen and Carl Jung actually had a back-and-forth exchange in letters where Dr. Jung provided his own insights on the Jerry Irwin case and what he thought was going on. Yeah, the Lorenzens really began to suspect that there was something else going on. In fact, they had tried to encourage Irwin to come to town and receive treatment from another doctor outside of the military. They also had hoped to try and hypnotize him and see if they could recover any of his lost memories, and seemingly, his superior officers tried to prevent him from doing this. In fact, it had even been the opinion of one of the doctors outside the military that the Lorenzens had been working with that Jerry seemed to be exhibiting behaviors that were consistent with a post-hypnotic suggestion that was causing him to forget some of what occurred to him. Now, although that may sound overtly conspiratorial, As Buhr notes in his book, and as some of the APRO files actually indicate, at one point the Lorenzans contacted the hospital the second time that Irwin was hospitalized after that fainting spell. They already had him listed as AWOL, but they said that records clearly showed that he was still there in the hospital. Now, why would he be in the hospital and receiving treatment, but listed as AWOL? This gravely concerned the Lorenzans. And as Buhr points out in his book, this was also right during the same time period that an illegal operation was being carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency known today as MKUltra, the full extent of which Americans will never really know the full truth about because the documents were destroyed illegally. We won't know because they don't want you to know. And frankly, some of what they did was probably too horrible. Now, can we prove that Jerry Irwin had been subjected to MKUltra mind experiments? No, we can't, but we do know, and this is historical fact, that plenty of people were during that era, and they were not willing participants. Many of them were subjected to these kinds of experimentation without their knowledge, and many aspects of Jerry Irwin's case do seem to fall into that category of a person who was being manipulated in some way without his knowledge or his consent. And that additional detail, in most cases, I would be very, very hesitant to even broach. But in the case of Jerry Irwin, I don't think we can rule it out. In fact, it very well may be an additional layer of complexity onto what is arguably one of the strangest cases that I have ever come across. But safe it to say, David Buhr's book, No Return, The Jerry Irwin Story, comes highly recommended, and I'll have more to say about this unusual case and maybe the MKUltra angle, too, for ex-subscribers. That'll have to be the final word on this week's edition of the program. Thanks to all of you out there who tuned in, and of course, as you always do, who support this program. Email me, info@MicahHanks.com. You can find me on Twitter, @MicahHanks, and of course, at MicahHanks.com online for all the other information about yours truly and what I'm up to. That about wraps it up, guys. You guys take care out there, and until next time, as always, stay strange.